You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. And this is This Week in Cardiology for April 14th, 2017. This week, I'm going to talk about cardiac arrest care, ICDs in patients with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, blood pressure control, readmissions for heart failure in the elderly, and cardiologist pay. First up, I want to start with the treatment of cardiac arrest. Now, many treatments in cardiology are approaching a point of diminishing returns. The treatment of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is not one of them. In this case, we have lots of room to improve survival. A Danish registry study published in the European Heart Journal sheds light on gains made in this country over the past decade or so when it comes to treating cardiac arrest. This was an observational nearly 42,000 patients who had out-of-hospital arrest between 2001 and 2013. The research team found a lot of encouraging results. First, there was an increase in the proportion of patients receiving bystander CPR, from as low as 18% back in 2001 to 60% in 2013. They also found that being admitted directly to an invasive center, a center that does PTCA, increased from 26% in 2001 to nearly half, or 45%, in 2013. And the bottom line was that 30-day survival rose from 5% in 2001 to 12% in 2013. So the three main results of this study were that admission to an invasive heart center and also regional use of PCI were associated with an improved 30-day survival. The distance from the site of the event to the invasive heart center was not associated with survival, and that survival was associated with population density, bystander CPR, witness cardiac arrest, and a shockable rhythm. I highlight this study because I think we can do so much better with cardiac arrest survival. There's so much room to go. Even in this study, a 12% survival, just making a small dent in that would have a large impact. Next up is the issue of non-ischemic cardiomyopathy and prevention of sudden cardiac death with the ICD. Now, no study that has enrolled patients with only non-ischemic cardiomyopathy have shown a statistically significant benefit to primary prevention ICD. The cardiomyopathy trial, the CAT trial, the DEFINITE trial, and now Danish trials were all negative. And before the Danish trial came out last year, North American guideline documents gave ICD placement in patients with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy the highest rating, a 1A recommendation. So how could this be with negative trials and the highest recommendation? Well, that recommendation was based on the findings of the SCUDHEF trial, which was an RCT that included only half of the patients that were non-ischemic and the other half were ischemics, and a meta-analysis by Desai et al. Published in JAMA back in 2004. And this was a meta-analysis of studies which was flawed in some ways because it included companion data, and companion was a CRTD trial. So the question remains, then, should ICDs be recommended in non-ischemic cardiomyopathy? A new meta-analysis published in JAMA Cardiology set out to answer this very question. And researchers found and included four RCTs of about 1,800 patients who had non-ischemic cardiomyopathy who received a primary prevention ICD versus placebo or medical therapy. Now, pooling data from these trials, the researchers showed that there was indeed a significant reduction in all-cause mortality with the ICD. The hazard ratio, the point estimate, was 0.75, and the confidence interval went from 0.63 to 0.93, so this was statistically significant. And they concluded that based on the totality of the evidence, their findings support the guidelines recommendation for ICDs. I say this is a tough call. It's a really tough call. I still implant ICDs for high-risk patients with non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, especially young patients. But there's no doubt that the probability of benefit in non-ischemic patients is less than ischemic cardiomyopathy patients, especially in older patients who have multiple comorbidities. Now, the highest weight of the study in this meta-analysis was from the SCUDHEF trial. The more contemporary trial, the Danish trial, which included older patients and a more robust therapy for heart failure, that contemporary trial failed to show a benefit. The researchers noted that they did not have access to patient-level data in the Danish trial, which is a limitation for sure. What we so desperately need in this area are better ways to risk stratify patients with non-ischemic and ischemic cardiomyopathy who stand to benefit most from the ICD. Next up is the issue of blood pressure targets. So the SPRINT trial famously showed targeting a blood pressure goal in high-risk non-diabetic patients of 120 versus 130 led to improved cardiovascular outcomes. And since publication of that trial back in 2015, controversy has only grown regarding the blood pressure measurements done in the SPRINT trial, that is, unattended measurements of blood pressure after 5 minutes of quiet rest. I mean, nobody does that in the real world. Also, SPRINT findings went the opposite way as ACCORD, which showed that aggressive blood pressure control in diabetic patients did not improve cardiovascular outcomes. Well, now, a reanalysis of data from two hypertension trials, which was published in Lancet, further questions the wisdom of aggressive blood pressure control. This group of researchers reanalyzed data from the 25,000 patient strong OnTarget trial and a 31,000 patient strong TRANSCEND trial. The researchers studied the lower boundary of achieved blood pressure in this group of patients. They found that the mean achieved systolic blood pressure less than 120 was associated with an increase in cardiovascular death and all-cause death. This association was not observed, however, for MI and stroke. Now, the mean achieved diastolic blood pressure less than 70 millimeters increased the risk for MI and hospital admission for heart failure. So before I suggested to you that these findings align well with my clinical observations and biases, that is, that aggressive blood pressure control definitely has heterogeneous effects depending on the patient, it's important to note that patients in this trial were not randomly assigned to specific treatments. The authors were quick to recognize that they cannot completely rule out some effect of reverse causality, indicating that morbidities can cause decreases in blood pressure and morbidity and mortality during the trial. But again, I highlight this because it complicates the issue of blood pressure targets, and I'm just not sure we have the right answer, and clinical judgment obviously is critical. The next topic is the heart failure treatment in elderly patients. And anyone who cares for elderly patients in the real world understands the, quote, revolving door phenomenon in which patients get discharged to the nursing facility and then readmitted and then so on. A large database survey study which was published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings found that patients hospitalized with a first-time diagnosis of heart failure and then discharged to a skilled nursing facility were about 50% more likely to be readmitted to the hospital than those who were discharged home from the hospital. The higher hazard ratio came after adjustment of the usual factors. Although patients are often told their stay will be short, this group found that the average stay to the skilled nursing facility was 144 days. The lead author, Veronique Roger, made a nice comment in the news story. She said, "This doesn't mean at all that we should cast blame on skilled nursing facilities, but it does mean that we need to address our expectations as providers and as families." I could not agree more. Expectations are key. Here's another nugget that my wife Stacy, a palliative care doctor, teaches me. She says that elderly patients that are declining because of multiple organ decline rarely, if ever, get stronger in a skilled nursing facility. And if we want heart failure care to be less heartless, it's incumbent on us clinicians to give patients and families realistic expectations and access to palliative symptom control. The next topic and the final topic is cardiologist pay or compensation. In Medscape's cardiologist compensation report, average income remained at about $410,000 per year, which is the third highest of all physicians. Yet only half of cardiologists feel fairly compensated. However, overwhelmingly, cardiologists in the survey reported that aspects of their job other than pay are more rewarding. Now, when asked about the most challenging aspects of their work, cardiologists most often cited rules and regulations, not night call. Nearly one in five cardiologists cited the EHR as the worst aspect of their job. My thoughts on pay are simple. I'm grateful to make so much money and to have had parents who helped me see the importance of hard work and education. My greatest frustration with work is the nonsense that distracts caregivers from the work of being with patients. EHR in its current form is nonsense. So are quality measures that certainly reduce healthcare quality. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I appreciate you listening. Thank you. See you next week.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.